Alright, I have stolen Reed's laptop.
Good.
What are you talking about? I can get fired for this.
Good.
Welcome to the Fan Gamer Podcast. This is episode 135. We're going to be talking about fun games this week. Last week we talked a little bit about shame games, and those are the games that, of course, we play. And we don't really like them enough to keep playing them, unless if you're John Megrim. This week, on the other hand, we're going to be talking about games that we find fun, games that we actually will pick up time and time again and we'll keep playing, because we know that the game mechanics that they have, they're just naturally fun for some of us. Whereas we're going to learn on the program today. We're also going to be trying our new format, so please let us know what you think about it, and we'll try to give you guys the best programming possible in the coming weeks. And yes, Ben and Charlie are here with me, and they're going to be doing some segments. I think up first we have Charlie talking a little bit about Groundlancer. So let's hear that.
How often do you enjoy a video game without touching the controller? I don't mean watching someone else play the game, and I'm not talking about Metal Gear Solid cutscenes either. Allow me to back up. For the past month or so, I've been spending my precious leisure time replaying Groundlancer Heritage of War for the PlayStation 2. Heritage of War came out shortly after Final Fantasy XII, I believe, so I tend to associate them with each other. They're kind of similar in gameplay, so I imagine many people wrote Groundlancer off at the time for seeming like a poor man's Final Fantasy XII. I played it anyway. The first two Groundlancer games to come to America were brought to us by Working Designs, the company that made me realize the power of good localization. Working Designs set the standard for great packaging, top-notch translation and script editing, and good voice acting. They offered special edition packaging before special editions were a thing, and you didn't even have to pay more for it. Groundlancer Generations was their final project before they faded away for good. Groundlancer is a series of tactical RPGs that features one of the most revolutionary ideas in tactical games, simultaneous actions. You tell your people what to do, and it all happens at once, which makes for much faster gameplay than, say, Final Fantasy Tactics. I was thoroughly impressed with the series. When Heritage of War came out at the same time as Final Fantasy XII, though, I decided to play Final Fantasy first. Heritage of War was localized by Atlus, and I don't hold them in as high regard as I do Working Designs. I was hesitant to play it. Final Fantasy XII had great mechanics. I sat there and figured them out until I could travel anywhere and do things I shouldn't be doing yet at certain parts of the story. I figured it out to the point that I went through an optional 4-hour boss battle barely paying any attention to it. I had my AI system set in such a way that I could change the channel and watch something else without worry. So that's what I did. I stopped playing shortly after that. I never finished the game, but I feel proud in knowing that I experienced all I felt I needed to in that game. Heritage of War was my next challenge.
What should I do?
Walking around and fighting things in Groundlancer felt a lot like Final Fantasy XII at first, but there was much more to it below the surface. You learn skills, magic, and passive abilities through a hexagonal grid system. You place a plate that represents a skill or ability on the grid, and then you choose a plate on the left to be the source of your flow, which determines which skills you're focusing on. Each plate can send that flow up and to the right, or down and to the right.
Yes?
The plates in the flow are the only ones that earn points and level up, so it didn't seem unreasonable to place several of the same plate along the same flow line to level up one ability rapidly. Each ability could get up to level 9, but each plate could only get up to level 5, so you could have up to 3 of the same plate on one character. After a while, I realized that having 3 of the same plates on the same flow line was a bad decision, since once they all got up to level 5, they would either add up to 15, which would be a waste of 6 levels, or they could add up to level 7 if they were removed from the line of flow, since plates outside of the flow are reduced to half their effective level.
Do you have a plan?
In hindsight, I would only need two in the line of flow to be at full effectiveness, or better, I could just have one in the line of flow and two outside of it to make the full level 9 ability. But wait, eventually I realized that there were things I could buy to move plates around and fix my mistakes. And for organizational purposes, I didn't even need to change the source of my flow anymore. I could keep a single line of flow with all my best abilities and just move things in and out of that line as needed in order to progress. This was particularly great since some characters had lucked out and got bi-directional plates. Those were plates that, instead of going either up and right or down and right, they went both ways, meaning that they had twice as many plates in the flow from that point onward. So with one of those plates as the source of the flow, and the ability to move plates in and out of those two branches, I could maximize my effectiveness. And then I discovered an item that I could buy that allowed me to copy a plate from one character to another. Suddenly I was deleting plates from some characters in order to allow them to have the bi-directional plates their ally had. And then I realized I could copy that same plate back to the original owner, giving them two bi-directional plates. And since another character had a different bidirectional plate, soon every character had four bidirectional plates, creating branches of branches in the line of flow, eventually making it so that there were more plates in the flow than out of it. So if there's more plates in the flow, then you can have more different abilities taking up. So if I could just get a list of all the abilities, open up a spreadsheet.
I think I broke it.
So then I took out a sheet of paper and tried to figure it all out. Drawing hexes was unnecessary, so instead I just used a grid, and instead of flowing up and right and down and right, it just flowed right or up and right. Make a list of available abilities. Each character needs their own page. And then suddenly, 2 hours had passed, and I hadn't even touched the controller. And it was fun. It reminded me of building a character in D&D, or planning out a role-playing session. It was pure fun to understand the mechanics and to use that knowledge to craft a new experience. Soon afterward, I broke the game. My characters were gods. Thankfully, by that time, the story had picked up and I kept playing through to the end, unlike Final Fantasy XII. I'll always be fascinated by the time I started enjoying the science of the mechanics of games rather than the action of them.
Hey, Sheris, if you weren't born into the Ceriltian royal family, what would you be doing now?
I imagine I'd be training every day. Not to win wars or protect people, but just to better myself, you know?
So, I guess nothing would be different.
That was Charles Verdon, our very own, doing a segment for the first time since, Rock Audio Candy. Audio Candy, yes. Yeah, Audio Candy. So, Charlie, what was it like doing Audio Candy back when you were doing that?
A lot of catch-up. If I knew that I had to do a segment, I'd suddenly start scrambling, checking OC Remix or wherever. I very rarely had anything planned out. I very rarely had something in mind whenever I started it.
Such is the life of a producer.
Yeah, I guess so.
I thought you said ketchup, like the tomato condiment.
Oh. But
no, definitely talking about ketchup in terms of trying to
get
something.
Well, you know, ketchup has natural mellowing agent. Never mind.
So that was our first segment for this new kind of format that we're trying. And you got to pretty much go over anything you wanted to talk about concerning game mechanics for that specific game, right?
Pretty much. I mean, there are other things about the game that really interest me, there are other game mechanics that I really like, but that was certainly an interesting revelation.
Well, Ben, you have a segment coming up on this, and I actually, I was talking to you about doing a segment for this show, and when you came up with this, I thought it was a really cool idea. Why don't you tell us about it?
Yeah. Yeah, basically I go into talking about real-time clocks that are used in games. It started with for me, at least, Pokemon Gold. I'm not really sure of any other games that used it before that.
Yeah, it was kind of a newer thing in the early 2000s, I think. That's when that came out.
Yeah, 2000, 2001.
Yeah.
And just how, like, I started noticing that a lot of things I like also employ that sort of thing. It's, like, not everything, but I just really like that as a mechanic, and, like, I have a lot of fun, weirdly enough, like, looking outside and being like, oh, it's dark, let's see what's going on in Animal Crossing right now.
Yeah.
Or just, like, silly stuff like that for some reason. Like, I mentioned in the segment that it, like, bridges the gap easier between, like, just playing a game and actual life, and it's cool.
And we'll get onto that, but I want to know, like, because for me, when I played those games and I was able to use those options, like, I think you go into the bug catching tournament in Pokemon in your segment. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, just elements like that, when I was playing, say, the Pokemon games, it made me feel a lot closer to the game.
Yeah, definitely.
Like, it really brought it into reality for me, in that you could feel like you were jumping into this this other world that was existing as a parallel to your own, as opposed to it being just a constant in its own right. Like, you play a game like Super Mario Brothers, just for example, you know, no matter what time you're going to pick up and play Mario, it's still going to be a bright, shining day that looks like a mushroom trip.
Yeah, definitely.
So, I mean, like,
it always is what it is. It's its own world. But when there's just that link between your world and the world of the game, it's a lot more interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely a mechanic I noticed when I was younger and thought it was very interesting also. So I'm glad that we get to do a segment on it, and we'll hear Ben explore that more. Charlie, did you think of an interesting game mechanic that you wanted to talk about but didn't have time to?
Yeah, not for that game specifically, but definitely rhythm-based game, I think. Mm. That's pretty much pure mechanics and doesn't have a story.
Yeah.
It is like Rock Band or DDR or anything like that.
Excuse me, Elite Beat Agents has a great story. I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, I didn't mention that one because I never played it.
But we're talking about the game mechanic that is like rhythm play. We're talking about synchronized movements on a controller or a big pad alongside with what's appearing on the screen.
Which, it's interesting because a lot of times the point at which I start getting really good at those kind of games is whenever I stop thinking about them so much. Like, I just just start letting my body react to the screen naturally, and then as soon as I start thinking, oh, wow, I'm doing really good at that, oh, man, I missed something.
Right, right. No, that happens to me too. I mean, I think the first game I actually got good at that was a rhythm game of any kind was probably Guitar Hero. Like most people, I'd assume, who didn't have the physical agility to do DDR or anything like that. They were good at Guitar Hero because they can move their fingers. But I remember feeling the same kind of emotion when I'd be playing a song. And you'd be playing on a pretty hard setting, and you're actually kind of impressing yourself with how whimsical your movements feel and how you're just kind of naturally hitting all the notes. I know there's a word for this, and I'm forgetting it right now, but it's when you just kind of become out of body and you become one with the actions that you're doing.
Zen?
Is it zen? I mean, I've heard people express it in the same thing with, like, driving long distances. And you've done that before, Charlie, so, like...
Oh, sure.
I mean, like, you become one with the car, or you become one with the controller, so to speak, and that you're just kind of acting without even thinking about it. But sure enough, as soon as you actually think about it, you either miss the chord or you run into an oncoming car.
The transcendence will only get you so far.
Yes, yes. Well, Ben, what about you? Are there any other games that you wanted to talk about, game mechanics, that you didn't get to touch on in your segment, besides the time ones?
It's not necessarily... Well, it is sort of a mechanic. When I first pitched you an idea that was a little more narrative-based, but thinking about it, it did have, like, sort of a mechanical aspect to it, and that was... like, figuring out, like, story puzzles in games like Phoenix Wright or other, like, sort of visual novel games
is
something I like figuring out. Or just in general, like, I mean, I could extend that to say I really like convoluted stories in games in general, and I like figuring those out. But more so in games like
If
like
you
mystery
figure
games.
It out, like, you like you know that the answer, there's going to be a big reveal in about 5 minutes, but you already know what that big reveal is because you connected the dots already.
Yeah,
and isn't that
yeah.
just the best feeling?
Yeah, it's great, and I guess I didn't think too much about that. I had more to say about real-time clocks and those memories attached to that, but yeah, I really do enjoy puzzle-solving, like, narratively and in games.
Yeah, going back to just a strict, like, bare-bones mechanic, I saw this one in the forum, and I actually was thinking about this, too, just
was
as
it
a
jumping?
Joke. Jumping. I want to go to jumping. Mario's original name was Jumpman.
That's true.
I mean, this was one of the game characters that came out and kind of put a milestone in gaming. The Mario games are always based on jumping, or at least that's one of the things you can count on always being in there. And what an interesting mechanic it is. You're just kind of running and jumping. And, I mean, that's what a lot of side-scrollers were. How did you guys, like... Did you guys feel restricted in games where you can jump as opposed to games where you cannot jump?
Right.
Like for instance, for me, like, playing Ocarina of Time, I hated that I couldn't jump.
Yeah.
I absolutely
you sort of
hated
could
it.
If you rolled off a cliff or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, but it didn't feel the same.
See, that was one of the things I liked most about Legend of Zelda Link's Awakening is because, for goodness sakes, you can finally jump. You have to have a special item to do it, but you can do it.
Yeah. Jumping is definitely something that I've always enjoyed doing in games because, one, it makes me feel like I'm doing more, that I have more control.
It's like whenever you're in, to continue this Zelda thing, whenever you're in Wind Waker and you're going down, like you're sailing from one island to another, the thing that will break up that monotony is you causing that ship to jump.
Which is perhaps even more unrealistic than having Link just jump in Ocarina of Time. I mean, they give you a big Hyrule field that you can go rolling through, but you can't jump through it.
Yeah, because it's very easy to, like, run and just, like, really quickly roll everywhere. Not so easy to just hop.
Yeah, I guess so. But I just love jumping.
it's interesting because most games where you can jump, it's like, you're jumping unnaturally high. Like, there are very few games where your character will jump at a normal human height of jumping.
And then from there, you can go into the birth of the double jump.
Yeah.
You can literally jump in a second time in midair.
Yeah. Like, who thought of that?
I don't know, but the first
time
I ever...
How does that even work?
Exactly. The first time I ever actually played a game that had that mechanic was Super Ghouls and Ghost. You can, as the main character, you can double jump. And it's kind of outstanding with the way it looks, because you'll clearly jump off the edge of a cliff or something, and then you can just jump back. Yeah, who knows how, but it's possible.
Sure.
I mean, that's a mechanic that definitely is it's a pro and a con. I mean, it's one
but
of the
it's certainly a fun mechanic in many ways.
Oh yeah.
It's fun until, like, you have games like Castlevania where, like, it becomes, like, this very strategic element where it isn't quite as free and it's very rigid and, like, there are repercussions to jumping. Or, like, in fighting games where, like, jumping at your opponent is never a good idea.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to something that's a bit more open and free than the double jump in which, like, in Super Ghouls and Ghosts, you jump in one direction and then if you jump the second time, you've chosen to fall off that cliff. let's go to something that's a bit more open, and I'd like to hear Ben's segment about real-time game mechanics.
It's the year 2001, February, a Tuesday afternoon. I'm in the fifth grade, and I'm on a bus for a school field trip. You know, electronic devices are never really allowed at school, but field trips always seem like that one little, not really, but sort of exception. When you feel just brave enough to try to listen to your CD player or bring your Game Boy Color, or in my case, still the old brick Game Boy, to play on the bus on the way to wherever you were going. Now, the second generation of Pokemon games, Gold and Silver, had just come out months ago, so everyone was playing it. And it was the first time I had brought my Game Boy to school, but despite all nervousness, I was determined to devote some of my bus time to catching them all. A friend of mine was fighting Whitney, the normal-type gym leader in Goldenrod City, just getting demolished by her rollout. I, however, felt a little touch of playground-style supremacy as I had just beaten Whitney and moved on to just the next screen past Goldenrod City and into the National Park. Because that's where my parents told me to stop playing the night before. The National Park was a beautiful place where you could catch tons of rare bug Pokemon, my favorite. Most rare of all was the shiny pink Butterfree, which I had only heard about on the playground, so I wasn't even sure if it was real. But it was where I started my adventure that day. Though, something was different than usual. Now, Pokemon Gold and Silver introduced the concept of a real-time clock, where at the start of the game you would tell the game the time, the day of the week, and whether or not it was currently daylight saving time. And as a kid, I never knew what that even meant. Like, they should have just asked if it was, like, spring or fall. It's a really dumb and confusing question for a little kid. But this was the first game I had ever played with that sort of mechanic in it. For the first time in a game, it would be nighttime if the game, if it were nighttime in real life. And it would be daytime in the game if it were daytime in real life. And it would be bedtime in real life regardless of how I wanted to change the clock in real life as easily as I could in the game. But what this meant was that there were new things to discover no matter what time of day or week you played the game. I knew of more simple things that you could only catch Ledyba or Spinarak, more of my favorite bug-type Pokemon, in the morning or at night respectively. But when I turned my game on that Tuesday and started it up, something amazing was happening. Suddenly, a voice comes on over the loudspeaker in the national park as I enter it. It's Tuesday! The bug-catching contest is today! I'm sorry, the what? It's what day? Now I'm forced to pick only one of my Pokemon to bring in with me. I pick my new, fresh Sudowoodo, a rock-type Pokemon that looks like a tree. A counter for 20 minutes starts, and a new background track starts off, way different and more intense than the usual serene jam that the National Park usually sports. And it's on before I knew it. There are tons of trainers like myself in National Park doing their best to catch the biggest Pokemon they can before the end of the contest. Well, turns out I made the wrong choice of which Pokemon to bring in with me. Sudowoodo is a rock type, and bug types are weak against rock. Especially weak against rock. So I'm essentially knocking out every bug I encounter in one hit. It's not going so well for me. And then I find a Pinsir, a Pokemon I'm sure will win me the contest. They're like huge horned beetle guys. I hit it once, hoping that it'll survive, and it does. It's at a sliver of health. I got it. I've technically won. Victory is within my grasp. And suddenly my friend elbows me to alert me that a teacher is coming down the bus aisle. I quickly hide my Game Boy. After she passes, I resume. Only to find that in the panic, I accidentally attacked Pinsir again. It got away. Now the contest ends and I end out with just a Kakuna, which I speedily captured only because we had arrived at our field trip destination. I'm beaten by, of all things, a Venonat. How lame. But that day, I experienced a very new and incredibly inspiring mechanic of gameplay that I had never even seen before, the real-time clock. I vowed to come back the next day there was a bug-catching contest and get that Pinsir that got away. And maybe someday, just maybe, I'll find that pink Butterfree. Since then, I've noticed a lot of my favorite games rely on a real-time clock. Pokemon continues in the trend of incorporating it, with the exception of the third generation of games. And admittedly, that's why I don't really like them as much. I'm quite fond of Tamagotchi, which is even a portmanteau of the words egg and watch in Japanese. Your Tamagotchi grows, lives, sleeps, poops, and dies all in real time, and you have to check on it throughout your day. For me particularly, mine continue to die because I've fallen into waking up around noon daily. Now I've been hoping for my Tamagotchi to fix my sleep schedule just as another excuse for me to wake up in the AM, just to someday have one Tamagotchi that doesn't hate me and run away. But it hasn't happened yet. A game that can somehow exist in real time alongside of your own life? It immerses you into the world of the game, bridging the gap between your life and your life as the player more smoothly than any other mechanic could. A game that can keep up with your life, in just a simple aspect such as time, is that much less of a game to you and something just a little bit more organic. Or at least to me. A game that continues to play in some way, even when you aren't.
Animal Crossing, free to GameCube!
Welcome to Animal Crossing, the life game that's happening every minute of every day, whether you're playing or not.
Trade you some wallpaper for your UFO.
You think I'm a chump? Try the raccoon.
Animal Crossing is far and above my favorite game. Sorry, Earthbound. The idea of the game that continues to play without you drew me in so much, even with such simple objectives and goals. Animal Crossing introduced seasons to the real-time formula, which was probably my favorite part of the game, how the world itself changed as the year progressed. Now, around that time, winter was probably my favorite season. Living in Virginia, we hardly ever got any snow, but I really loved Christmas and the general feeling of warmth and romance and togetherness that the season could convey, and just the possibility of one day waking up with everything covered in fluffy white always had me excited. Animal Crossing provided me with a winter world full of snow and lights, one that I couldn't get in my own life. Having fun and making snowmen I couldn't make in real life, sending presents to my animal friends to be delivered in one full business day, and having Christmas pass and the lights dissipating, just as it did in real life. It just created really lasting and fun memories for me. I was up late one night making snowmen to get furniture and doing errands for a spooky ghost. And after a long night of work, I start to drift away into sleep. So I decide to go into my room in the game and lie down in bed, instead of actually doing that in real life, you know? But not before placing my new treasure next to the bed, the snowman TV. It played such a serene melody, as white pixelated snow fell from the dark blue sky on the screen. I looked out of my own window into the night sky, hoping that that would be a scene I could experience. The melody put me to sleep, and the game stayed on all night. And the sun rose and shone brightly through both of my windows. Both windows in two different worlds.
Aww. Wasn't that cute? Ben did a great job on that. I'm really excited that we got to try this new format this week.
Yeah, definitely.
I think we got to say a lot more than we usually do. But maybe you, as the audience, feel otherwise, so let us know.
Yeah, send us a voicemail, 503-446-CAST.
Or, if you feel that we could do better, or you have ideas, or you'd like to even be on the podcast and do a segment, or to be interviewed, send Charlie an email. Charlie is, well, we're all three of us are producing this show to try and bring more segments like those to you guys. And I'm just kind of lumping this responsibility onto Charlie for you guys to contact him.
Yeah.
Charlie, what are your feelings on that?
Yeah, I can do that.
All right, fair enough. We got voicemails.
Oh, let's check them out.
Well, hello, Fan Gamer Podcast crew. This is Ned. So, the subject for this week is something that is super interesting to me for a couple reasons. The whole shame game thing. Let me tell you why, because I've got two particular examples I want to give. Now, number one might not be exactly what you're looking for. It's not so much a shameful game as a game that I'm ashamed of how I play it. I've been playing through Saints Row 3 recently, and normally when I play these open-world crime spree games, I almost play it nice. It's like, I don't want to hit random pedestrians. I don't want to go out of my way to be a huge jerk. But for some reason, something about the presentation of Saints Row 3 just makes me revel in my crime. It gives me the desire to play this crazy topless female mob boss, almost, who also has an extremely deep male voice and regularly goes around punching your enemy characters, well, in places that they probably shouldn't be punched, but, you know, they're in the way.
Somebody's getting twisted.
But the game that everyone has been telling me for years now that I should be ashamed of liking, Final Fantasy X-2. Now, I hear it already. Oh, it's another guy who loves pretty princess dress-up adventures.
Sure.
But tell me this.
Tense.
How many of you guys grew up watching Sailor Moon in the mornings?
Nope.
I mean, come on.
Yes.
That show was
yes.
great.
I'm with you. I'm with you.
I watched the last, like, 5 minutes of it before Pokemon.
So maybe sometimes magical transformations aren't all that. But even then, once you look past the pretty princess dress adventure, you're left with a pretty great game. It has what's one of the fastest, sort of actioniest combat sequences in a Final Fantasy game. It's hard to describe. It's almost just like, it's not quite real time, but it moves so quickly, it may as well be. At the same time, one of the things that draws me to it is the fact that the story is a little more lighthearted than your standard Final Fantasy fare. I don't find myself immediately under pressure to save the world or be part of this crazy terrorist organization that's taking down the big bad corporate entity. I don't know. I feel like that game deserves a little more credit than people give it, but it doesn't change the fact that I've spent almost 10 years being told I should be ashamed of it. Well, either way, thanks for an interesting show topic, guys, and can't wait to hear the show.
What's up, man?
What a nice gentleman.
Yeah, I'm on his side. I own a Tamagotchi. I like Sailor Moon. We're down.
Yeah? See, I always, like, add this really deep attraction to Sailor Moon. But then I realized she was a cartoon character.
Are we getting
character,
into that?
And let's just not talk about it. There's a second part.
What ho, podcast crew. This is Vid again. I just wanted to add a quick little PS to my last message. Just wanted to give a shout out and thanks to all of the Fangamer crew for making me and all of my friends feel extremely welcome during PAX. Mm-hmm. At no point did I feel like we were just annoying customers to be dealt with. We felt like part of the community, something special. So thanks for that.
Oh, man.
Well, that was completely unintentional. Sorry. Yes, just a very quick one about last week and about how nice Fangamer is.
Yeah, wow. Thanks a lot.
And how beautiful Sailor Moon is. You're looking at me weird, Charlie.
I don't know, but I'm being Sailor Moon fan.
Well, y'all need to stop busting. Anyway,
I'm sorry. Look out for
the new show coming out. It'll be dope.
I liked Sailor V better. I'm sorry.
Oh.
Wait. Oh, talking about Venus?
Well, yeah. Well, she was doing her thing in Europe for years before Sailor Moon even realized that she was a special moon princess from the moon.
Okay, now you guys are just talking way over my head.
All right, what's the Fangamer news?
Yes, we got a little bit of Fangamer news. Not much, but enough. We're staying busy. Reed just got back from out of town. He was on vacation last weekend.
He went to Idaho to plan the most tame bachelor party ever.
Good.
There was little crab cakes and paintball guns.
And laser tag!
You can hope.
One could only hope. That would be, actually, if I ever have a bachelor party, I'm going to have it just be 1 6-hour laser tag match.
Just go to golf and stuff.
Golf and stuff, yes.
Can't get enough.
But besides...
Especially not after 6 hours in that tiny little...
We got all the Chris Furness Kickstarter stuff in.
Almost of it. I don't think we got all of it, but we definitely got the books in.
Got the books, we got the shirts, and the exclusive poster.
Yeah. I think we're just missing a few smaller prints. But.
For those of you who don't know who Chris Furness is...
chump.
What?
You're a chump.
We could talk more about that next time, right?
We could. But for those of you who just don't know who he is, Chris Furness had a successful little Kickstarter involving Zero Suit Samus and doing a book about her 31 days of having fun not saving the galaxy. I think that's what the basis is.
Yeah.
Okay. Check it out if you haven't looked into him already. Besides that, what else?
We've just been focusing on getting a lot of the Kickstarter stuff ordered
and
getting that out. And some stuff from our fall line.
We got not too long ago. We got the redone Cards of Legend in those came in, and we finally have those in stock now. So for people who want to get either the newer version to add to your collection, or because you didn't have time to get them because you were out of stock already, because it sold really fast.
Yeah.
But these are genuine bicycle made card decks. Which are great.
And they come in two colors now. Two flavors. Blue and red. It's flavors.
Are you confusing colors and flavors again, Charlie?
No, there is a difference, but they sound very much the same.
When I put peanut on the Earthbound and I try to chew on the screen, it doesn't taste like peanut.
Well, that's because...
Get a peanut cheese bar. Well, what have you guys been playing lately? You guys been doing anything? Ben, you were talking about a game.
Yeah, I'm playing this new game that came out either like a week or so ago, maybe a little more, called FTL. It's a sort of like tactical game. The best way to describe it would be like a roguelike, but in space.
Right.
And you guys don't know what a roguelike is, so it's kind of hard to describe. Like other games that are like the Mystery Dungeon series. Like Ancient Domains of Mystery is another one. They're mostly like dungeon crawler sort of games, but this one takes place in space. You're in a ship, and I'm really bad at describing it just because like it's such a unique idea for a game. Basically, like you're on the run from like a rebel force, I guess, and you're like one of the few like Federation ships alive. You have to get to the other end of the galaxy before they catch up to you and destroy you. And the object of the game isn't really to beat it more than it is to, you know, get as far as you can and then start over. And that's mostly how roguelike games sort of operate. Where, like, there's never, like, too much emotional connection to, like, the people you're playing as. It's more about experiencing that, learning things, getting better, and just playing it over and over again. And it's very addictive gameplay, and it's awesome and fun and great.
So sorry. Charlie, have you been playing any games?
As I've been discussing, I've been playing Growlancer, and I'm still not quite done.
Right.
Very close, though. And then once I'm done with that, I really want to pick up To the Moon on Steam.
Well, you said in your segment, though, that your characters have essentially become gods. They're undefeatable.
Oh, yeah. I'm destroying things already. Yeah.
So, is the game really long? Like, how have you not beaten it yet?
I'm very busy, so I only really get to play it on the weekends for the most part.
Oh, okay.
Just because they're already gods doesn't mean I can't still improve upon them. I still got some tweaks to make here and there. I still got to find their ultimate equipment. I mean,
every god has its faults.
You know, I think that's a really good way to end our show. The truth is, every god has their faults. Actually, I'd like to...
Every rose has its thorns.
Very nice. I like what Charlie said most, I think. Even though they're gods, I can still improve upon them.
There you go. And with that, good night.
Good night, everybody. Rest in peace. Rest in peace. All right, everybody, let us know what you thought of our show. Ben, what is the number they can call?
503-446-CAST. Hey, guys, it's 11:11. Make a wish.
Wait, that's not the time that you need to be... No, that's 12:34.
Yeah, 12:34, time to be nice to a girl. 11:11,
right.
Make a wish.
Gotcha. All right, cool.
But yes, 503-446-CAST. Leave a voicemail. Don't hold your breath.
Don't hold your breath. And for those of you as lost as I am, this is Jeff Benson signing off from Tucson, Arizona.
Lost as you are? You never heard of the 11:11 thing?
It sounded great. Well, no, I know what you guys are talking about, but I was trying to side with the audience because they're not going to understand.
Well, everyone knows about it. Everyone's in that mix.
You think
everyone
so?
Knows what?